It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you things you can't unlearn.
Hello, and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 165. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Chad.
I'm Keeper John, and tonight we've got an esteemed guest with us to discuss new angles on cosmic horror, Sam Reardon.
Hey!
Hey, welcome! Sam is the content lead for Meta Arcade, the company responsible for the interactive storytelling game Cthulhu Chronicles. So, Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to get in deep and just, like, go for it and talk about cosmic horror. I've learned a lot working on Cthulhu Chronicles, and hopefully we can talk about some cool stuff.
Yes, let's do that.
That's awesome. Great. Welcome, Sam. And we're happy to announce that this episode is sponsored by Squamous Studios, and we'll have some more to say about that in a little bit. Thanks, Squamous Studios, for the support. So to kick things off, let's open up the Campus Crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
The Campus Crier is Miskatonic U's student paper. Here's where we go through Mythos-related news and feedback to the podcast. This episode was recorded on January 17th, 2019.
The EN Forum had a poll for favorite gaming podcasts, and the results were announced on the Morris's unofficial tabletop RPG talk podcast. They did 10 from each category, a category of 10 RPG talk shows and 10 RPG actual play podcasts. So you can listen to that podcast to hear the entire list. But if you just want to quick and dirty, we've got the top four for each of those categories. For RPG talk show category, number four was Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff. Number three was Fear the Boot. Number two was the Grognar Files. And the number one show was our friends, the Good Friends of Jackson Elias. So, yay, congratulations to them.
Congratulations, guys. That's awesome.
Congratulations to everybody. Yeah, to everybody. But so neat that they made the top. And then for the top four RPG actual play categories, number four was Dungeons and Randomness. Number three was Androids and Aliens. Number two was Glass Cannon. And the number one actual play show is The Adventure Zone. So congratulations to them as well.
Guys. Yep, that's pretty cool.
That is awesome.
So the Campaigner magazine number 26 has an 8-page special feature about Call of Cthulhu with a long interview with line editor Mike Mason. The digital edition is just $1 and it's well worth the read. You have a link. It is in the show notes.
Also, Chaosium is looking for GMs for the upcoming year. You can find information about that on their website. We have a link in the show notes. Check it out.
Chaosium also announced their latest Call of Cthulhu licensee, Dogmite Games, who seem to make wooden keeper screens at about $300 US each, so pretty hefty. They also make dice boxes and things like that. It is far too rich for my blood, but for those who may be interested, we do have a link in the show notes.
Golden Goblin Press has posted a teaser about an upcoming Kickstarter. The project is called An Inner Darkness. To quote some of the blurb here, the dark and the malevolent forces of the Cthulhu mythos mostly ignore humankind, but these entities are also shrewd opportunists. Many of them see humans as a resource to be harvested, corrupted, and enlisted for their dark plots. Humanity, with all its noble aspirations, has many flaws. Greed, lust, envy, hatred, and fear are ripe fruits for these forces to exploit. Division and separation makes the humans easier to control. As investigators square off against the worst aspects of mankind, they also find themselves entangled with the parasitic powers of mythos. Also, a new free downloadable PDF has been added to the Golden Goblin Press website. It's called The Adepts of Terrace, and it's a group for it's a group scenario for Cthulhu Invictus. Also, there is a tip jar on the company website now as well.
Stygian Fox, this is going back a little bit, announced a couple of months ago, actually, but we missed it. So thought we'd mention that it's an overarching campaign framework written by Jeff Moeller that ties together the scenarios in The Things We Leave Behind, which is a couple of Kickstarters back now. This was a backer-only reward for the Kickstarter, but now it's been fully delivered for backers, and so that mini campaign frame is now available publicly, and you can get it on DriveThruRPG via the link in the show notes.
Cthulhu Reborn has released a free / pay what you want 27-page PDF scenario for Dateline Lovecraft, written by Noah Lloyd. He is half of the Reckoning of the Dead website. It's described as a rather gruesome newspaper-linked scenario called Smoke Green, set entirely in Arkham. When millionaire industrialist Reinhardt Lane picked Arkham to be the site of his grand new tobacco rolling factory, few would have predicted the rapid good fortune that his new Reinhardt cigarettes would achieve. So, we have a link in the show notes to go check that out.
Also, a cover image for an upcoming Chaosium book called Secrets of Berlin has been stealth released on social media. At press time, we've only seen the cover, which tells us the subtitle is Unveiling the Mythos in Weimar Berlin, and we know that David Larkins is the lead writer on this, with Mike Mason and Lynn Hardy. And can we say that this has got to be my favorite cover, period.
It's super beautiful.
It's really beautiful. Really nice.
It's really beautiful. There's also, if you go to the Chaosium Facebook, they posted a wrap version of the entire painting. Right. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I saw that.
It's beautiful.
It's really, really nice.
Gorgeous.
Chaosium
now has an official Twitch channel. Digital content producer Jamie Kokiat is leading the Twitch initiative. He said, "Our aim here is not only to promote Chaosium games and build up our content library, but also to engage with the Twitch and YouTube communities and to reach new players, especially younger players who make video platforms their home. Each time we stream, we'll be uploading the stream plus a best of recut," which I have to say is like work, to YouTube. Yeah. So they're beginning with a session of Horror on the Orient Express, and check it out in the show notes.
Very cool.
A word from our sponsor. Actually, you know, thank you very much to Squamous Studios for signing on as the official sponsor for episode 165. We're pleased to announce that the company has launched the first expansion for Feed the Shoggoth, Morsels of Madness. Feed the Shoggoth, Morsels of Madness will include 42 cards featuring new cult factions, new artifacts, new spells, new minions, rules, summaries for players, and more. So this is has anybody been able to play test like a beta version of this, or any advanced players for this? No,
I haven't. Maybe I've not beta tested this. No, but I have seen some of the card designs for it, and they look really, really cool.
Yeah, the art is awesome. Also, there's a really cool card that is called, I think it's called Shoggoth Frenzy. Boy, I hope I get it right. Anyway, it adds Shoggoth. So if you played the game before, I know, Murph, you have. John, have you played the game? I can't remember.
No, I have not.
All right, yet. Well, listen, you, there's this Shoggoth, and it moves around, and you feed cultists to it. Well, there's a Shoggoth Frenzy card, which adds Shoggoths to the table, so you have rotating, like,
yeah, that's
two,
frightening.
Yeah, right. it's total game changer.
Yeah, it is. There is it's twice the Shoggoth fun, he says. It summons a second Shoggoth onto the table to behave just like the first one, so now you've got to feed both Shoggoths if they're in front of you. Oh man, I didn't think of that. You get hit both. Oh, that stinks, right? Man.
Yeah, I guess they could stack up and you get both in front of you at the same
yeah,
time.
You'd have to feed them both with, oh man, that's not fun. If you haven't played this game, Feed the Shoggoth, you should definitely go and check it out. And you should definitely back the Kickstarter for the Morsels of Madness. It's actually funded as of right now. It looks like it's not very far behind, or I think it's $3,600 of the $3,500 goal right now. There's 26 days to go, guys. It's coming out one way or the other. It's a fun game. I love playing it, and you should definitely get the expansion.
Absolutely. Yep. So it's live now. Check it out. We have a link, a giant link, in the show notes. Smash it.
Yeah.
Welcome to the listening room. Rewind your reels and enjoy your selections in silence.
Shh. Agent Dinos is back with another FBI dossier to review, redact, or shred. This time, listeners may detect a familiar recommendation.
Okay, got another old archived file. Looks like 1926. So this was a joint investigation between the Department of the Interior and the Department of Energy. The official story is the standard corruption and bribery scandal leading up to the Teapot Dome scandal of the 20s. Huh, I'll have to look into that. It seems as though some geologists were surveying for oil and stumbled across some kind of underground complex in the Powder River Basin. The geologists blasted their way into the complex using dynamite, and once inside found something very interesting. They were, quote, multiple dead insect-like things, but larger than any known insects. There were also panels that looked like operator stations in New York or Chicago, but not labeled in English or any known language. It appears that the oil fields were given to the Sinclair Company in exchange for control of the complex by the Navy and Energy Departments. And the scandal was arranged as a cover, also because Interior Secretary Fall was loath to give the Navy access to the complex. Oh, here's an interesting addendum. It seems that several panels in the complex became operative again in the mid-1970s, at which time the Energy Department began disassembling the complex. That process isn't documented here, from what I can see, but there are notes indicating items were moved to Cheyenne Mountain. Well, aside from a complex no one can prove existed, there's nothing crazy here. We can digitize this. More grist for the internet conspiracy mill.
That's funny. I like how they twisted the Teapot Dome scandal there with giant insects. It was pretty cool.
Yes. Awesome. Love it. Teapot Dome scandal was kind of like the Watergate scandal of the 20s. And it brought down some people in the administration. There was a senator. Oh, boy. Am I going to recap this, really?
No, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. Go look it up, the Teapot Dome scandal. It was some crazy stuff, early American politics. It's crazy. Please remember that if you have any interest in producing a segment for the podcast, please contact mup.feedback@gmail.com.
So here we are in the feedback, and here's the first bit of feedback we've got. Starts out, hey guys, it's like a Christmas miracle. All four of you are in at the same time. In regards to the titles that Chris Spivey is working on, I seem to recall him mentioning that he was working on a Cthulhu with superpowers themed game. Yes, you remember correctly. So that could be the Stillwater one. Well, maybe. Or not, you know. So keep up the good work and go Pods. And that was from Judge Jim Yoder. Thanks, Jim.
And here's one from the show, Mike Medwick. Greetings, esteemed gentlemen. I greatly enjoyed your extended discussion of Cracked and Crooked Mance, a venerable scenario that can offer a very serviceable introduction to the Lovecraftian milieu for those new to the game. It's also one that's well-suited to allow new capers to stretch their riffing and tweaking skills to address some of those awkward scenario elements you dealt with in this episode.
And Mike, who I'm so happy to hear from you, Mike. Mike goes on to say, I was tickled, absolutely tickled, I tell you, to hear that you have fond recollections of the single session of Crickets.
Crickets?
Crickets Mance. I ran for you back in 2015. Dan's private investigator truly stood out in that session, but if I recall properly, you all originally decided that the entire party would be comprised of lawyers.
Which set me
scrambling to invent some kind of skullduggery on the part of the Dodge brothers. that the party could uncover during their investigation of the house. Interesting. I think Murph is absolutely right to say that somebody needs to die in this scenario to showcase what the monster can actually do, but I never really liked the Joe Varelli angle. That was the reporter who shows up with an axe for no reason.
Right.
I've got an axe. Did you guys need an axe?
I was just chopping some wood on my way over here.
I was just acting like a serial killer. You guys want to role play with me?
Hey, guys, did your lights just go out and the lightning just started? I don't understand why you're so scared.
I was just going to hold this axe up aloft and just see if I could catch some lightning.
Just sharpened my hatchet. Catch the gleam. Maybe I can light up your living room.
Instead, quote, my plan was to have Reginald Dodge send some hired muscle to the house to deal with the investigators while they were on the site. That makes sense. The idea was to engineer a gonzo three-way confrontation between the party, the monster, and the bad guys. That does sound a little bit comical and fun, in which several NPCs could get killed and some in some spectacularly gruesome ways. Absolutely. A, maybe it would have worked, maybe not. In any case, I bitterly regret not finishing the scenario with you guys. Me too, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. And Mike closes with, as always, the MUP crew really shines when they turn their attention to workshopping scenarios in this way. And what a treat to hear all four of you together again for this episode. Keep up the great work and greetings from the Great Plains of Nebraska. Kind of like living on the Plateau of Ling, only more desolate and windblown.
Ouch.
Go Pods. Thanks, Mike.
It was awesome,
so
Mike.
So good to hear from you.
Yeah, for real.
Totally.
I read that as turn their attention to worshiping scenarios in this way. And I was like, yeah, that works too, though.
Sure, yes. I worship. I think I worship Paper Chase, I would say.
I would say you do. It's almost frightening.
Settle down now, class. It's time for your next lesson.
All right, so now we're into the main topic, and we're going to talk about a few things. Now, Sam Reardon is, as described on a website known as LinkedIn.
Well done. You found me.
Yes. And you can edit this as needed, but an interdisciplinary writer with a passion for interactive storytelling and unique gameplay experiences, seeking to push the importance of diverse characters and their emotional connection with the audience. Does that sound about right? I think you wrote it.
I certainly did, so I will stand by it. No, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Awesome. And you are content lead for Cthulhu Chronicles,
mm-hmm.
as we mentioned at the top of the show.
Yeah.
And I'll let you kind of take the helm here on describing what Cthulhu Chronicles is. It's interactive fiction in the Lovecraftian setting of Call of Cthulhu. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good high-level summary of it. Basically, Cthulhu Chronicles came out of a partnership with Call of Cthulhu's own Chaosium, and we took a lot of scenarios that people are familiar with, like Blackwater Creek, Alone Against the Flames, Paper Chase, and a bunch of other scenarios, and combined those with some original content to create a cohesive narrative arc across 9 adventures that they kind of play like interactive fiction versions of game books. And they're all solo play as well. It's important to note. I'll say that. It's the second app we've done. The first one we did was Tunnels and Trolls Adventures, which is an adaptation of Tunnels and Trolls, the second tabletop RPG published after Dungeons and Dragons. So we're really into the RPG space, and Call of Cthulhu was super attracted to us. I mean, I've always been fascinated with horror and cosmic horror in particular. And I think with this game, we were able to explore the intersection between solo play and interesting sort of new narrative and the familiar and unfamiliar content of existing Call of Cthulhu. So you have 6 characters to choose from. who have different stats, they have different backstories. All of this factors into the way that the game plays. So there's replayability there between the different characters, and you accrue clues, which act a little bit like achievements and a little bit like variable tracking elements, where across the stories, across the adventures, we check to see which achievements you have, which clues you have. And then we open up new pathways, we close pathways. There's a lot of sort of crosstalk across the adventures to really weave them together that way. Oh, and also we are currently working on a second campaign, Mythos Across America. And I wrote almost the entirety of the first campaign, but for the second one, we got the chance to work with a lot of great freelance writers, who some of whom are veterans, some of whom are new voices, and they all had really interesting perspectives. So we'll have a lot of new original content soon.
Ooh,
very cool.
Yeah. So when does that get rolled out? When are we going to see the names of those creators and stuff like that?
Well, so the creators themselves, I can tell you the names right now. We have Greg Buchanan, who's super cool. He worked on No Man's Sky. We have Giada Zavaris, who is working on a game called Selling Sunlight and has also worked in Fail Better Games incubator program, which is where she started working on Selling Sunlight. I mean, do you want me to just keep rattling off?
Yeah, okay, cool. Sure. Cool. Absolutely. We love new names.
Cool, cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, so Sarah Longthorn is another one. So the interesting thing now is we also worked with some freelance writers on a project that hasn't quite been announced yet. So I might have to stop there for fear of confusing myself.
Totally fine.
But I can hint at even more freelance writers working on this semi-unannounced project.
Okay, well, it's announced now. We are in front of thousands of people right now.
I mean, so this new project is really... I say semi-announced because it is the Meta Arcade platform. I mean, so we recently announced closed beta, which is coming up in February. And what that means is we'll be launching a semi-private, you have to register for it, but it's basically a beta run for our platform, which includes a player similar to the iOS and Android apps that we already have out for Tunnels and Trolls and Cthulhu, but on PC. And along with that, we are going to be launching, finally, our creator engine, which allows people to use the same tools we've been using to publish our stuff to publish their own stuff and monetize it.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so we're going to be making...
This will be digital stuff.
Exactly, yeah. It's
oh my gosh.
And you'll be able to upload your own art and audio, and of course, your own words. But we'll have a lot of resources there for, you know, tips and tricks for writing. We'll have style guides. And our engine has a lot of cool features that... I mean, one of the things that I think makes us different from a lot of other sort of interactive fiction companies and tools is that we started with a focus on RPGs. So within our engine, there's built-in monsters and combat and achievements and stats and things like that, where the barrier of entry is still very low. So we handle all the crunchy stuff, basically, all the math behind the scenes and stuff. But the more qualitative things, that's where the users come in and can influence, you know, how difficult do I want this monster to be to beat? What do I want the monster to be called? Do I want to affect the player's stats in some way? Do I want to give them an achievement? Things like that that aren't necessarily available on other tools and platforms, which we think is really exciting for us.
That's fantastic.
I haven't played the Tunnels and Troll games that Meta Arcade does, but I do have a Cthulhu Chronicles account. I've been playing through the adventures. I really really like the spin dial thing, you know.
Spinny thing is awesome.
Meta Arcade could have very easily have done, you know, digital dice and had, you know, some sort of thing that made it look like tumbling dice or and sound effects and stuff. But instead of going with that route, they did this spinner, and because it's completely different, it feels like it's a unique experience with that, with that app, and it's very enjoyable. And I almost wish there were more in the stories that I've played so far. I wish there were more options that had skill checks where I needed to do the spinner and find out, hey, am I going to be successful or not? And it was very, very entertaining. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thanks so much. Yeah, the spinner was, so we did actually have dice in Tunnels and Trolls, the app. And then when we went into developing Cthulhu Chronicles, we were thinking more magic, less math is, I think, the philosophy we were talking about, which is creating a slightly different, a sort of lower barrier of entry where if a casual player is coming up on this game without being from the RPG space, they might not know about dice and how all that works. And the spinner felt like a very interesting visual that we could put in. So I'm glad that you liked it.
It seriously works. I really like it a lot.
Awesome. Thank you.
I'm really enjoying the writing. I'm going through Crimson. Well, it's true. Crimson Letters. And I will confess that I saw that it is your favorite, at least according to the Chaosium interview. Yep. I was like, yeah, I'll definitely play through that one. I really like the characters. It's really rich.
Thank you.
I like that scenario anyway, so it's very cool.
Yeah, that was, I mean, not to, if it's okay if I ramble on a bit, I absolutely will.
Totally.
Okay, cool.
It's a talk show.
Fair enough. You're right. That was absolutely my favorite one to write. And it's, I think, the same reason that you liked it. It's because of all the characters. A lot of, you know, Cthulhu stories are about isolation. A lot of cosmic horror is about isolation and the fear that comes from loneliness and it's sort of the fear of the dark type thing. What I liked about this was it was almost a break from that, but at the same time, it was it's a different kind of horror than the fear of loneliness. It's the distrust of other people. You know, what happens when you go from all these scenarios where it's you against the entire world and you're alone and your sort of allies are coming and going and you're never quite sure you can trust? What happens when you're thrust into a totally different world where everything is about subterfuge and you don't quite know where you stand with anyone? And a lot of the characters are purposefully obscuring their motivations in that scenario.
Yes.
And to some extent, I borrowed from the original scenario, and I also added sort of my own spin on characters and created new ones. I was so, so fascinated by the character of Mr. Wick. The whole adventure revolves around him, even though not to spoil it, but he has the biggest role in the beginning and the end of the adventure, but his presence is felt throughout because he's very much like Varys from Game of Thrones, where he has his fingers and all, like, you know, he's got the spider web and he's pulling all the threads.
Oh, right. That's very cool.
Yeah. No, I was so into, and he's got like a crazy deal and backstory, and I won't go into it too much for spoilery reasons, but he has like such an affable menace about him. And that's one of my favorite kind of characters to write, is someone who is definitely villainous and definitely evil, but you can't quite help but be fascinated by them because they're like really personable in a creepy way.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
It's right. It's sort of harmless, nice, charming, seeming on the outside. There is that scene with the party at Wick's mansion. And I really had the experience of mingling around with the different groups of people that it felt very much like I feel at a party, which is usually uncomfortable.
yeah, there may have been some projection in the writing there for me.
And it just, you get to decide sort of these groups of people and whether you approach them and try to vibe them out. And do you say nothing and kind of hang back and wait for cues? And do you spar with someone and push back to actually, you know, get in their good graces? Or was that a bad move because they're actually kind of a sensitive person? It's pretty, pretty rich stuff. And it gave me hives just feeling like I'm at a party. So
I'm glad that came across. That was definitely, I mean, they say write what you know. And I think, not to get into another writerly sort of ramble, but definitely to get into a writerly sort of ramble. I think a lot of the time when people think of the phrase write from what you know, they're thinking about, oh, I can only write about people like me, or I can only write about places I've been to. I think, honestly, the more interesting and true to me application of that phrase is write what emotions you know. Write from a place of emotional truth, and find emotional through lines in characters that get you interested about them. Like, the characters that I wrote in Cthulhu Chronicles, and that I adapted from Call of Cthulhu scenarios, they are very unlike me. I mean, of course they are. If they were all me, it would be a very boring story. But the way I was able to connect with all these characters is to find some aspect of their personality or some aspect of their psyche that I could relate to or at least understand. And that for me is where I really find the most interest in writing. So I'm glad that came across in Crimson Letters, because that's why I had such a blast writing it, which is this crazy cast of characters who all have their own motivations and likes and dislikes and attitudes, and surfacing all of that in different layers. And yeah, it was really great.
Yeah, and managing trust. That was my main takeaway, too. Yeah, for sure.
I'm working my way still through Cthulhu Chronicles. I'm using Charles Laney, the dilettante. and so far I've been successful in achieving the goal of each scenario. And I'm actually about to start Eyes of the Law, which you wrote.
Yes.
So I'm kind of waffling on whether I ask any questions because I haven't played it yet. So, but I just saw that. And I'm like, yeah, I can't wait to get into that next one. So,
yeah, I think that's the first one in the campaign that was completely original.
Yes,
it's that one, and then Miskatonic University, and then The Good Professor, and then Miskatonic University. Those are the three that were totally from my own brain. That said, they all borrow characters and motifs from Call of Cthulhu scenarios that were adapted for the other adventures. So they're really sort of, they were formulated as connective tissue between these seemingly disparate scenarios.
That is awesome.
Yeah. We started the whole process by talking with Neil from Chaosium, Neil Robinson, and he came over. He works in the Seattle area, so he stopped by our office, and he and I and our executive producer just sat down and talked through what scenarios we thought would fit well together, which ones would form the narrative, what narrative we wanted to do, and we ended up pulling together a really interesting story from these very disconnected scenarios. I mean, all these scenarios are totally disparate. But by pulling certain threads that we found very compelling from various adventures, we were able to keep some truths of those stories and keep the hopefully the feeling and familiarity, but bring a unique and connected story to the campaign overall.
Yeah, that turns it into a campaign and yeah. borrowing from or elements from the other scenarios, that in and of itself, it feels very Lovecraftian because the Lovecraftian writers borrowed from each other, and that's how they connected and created a shared universe. And I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, I'm glad you agree. that was very much the attitude taken of, I mean, the mythos is built on layers and layers of people building off each other and feeding off prior content and adding to it and responding to content that other people have made with their own. I think it's fascinating stuff. And
Before you wrote those games for Cthulhu Chronicles, had you ever played Call of Cthulhu or any of the other Lovecraftian tabletop games?
I really hadn't. I'd played some Dungeons & Dragons. I'd played a few other games here and there. And I played a lot of RPG video games. But I didn't really have a group of people that were willing to play spookier games with me. So I didn't really have a chance to. That said, I have now, which is nice.
Oh, awesome.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
I have to imagine Seattle's got a pretty good RPG tabletop community.
We know a lot of people in that area that it shouldn't be hard to find a group.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and I think that's something that keepers do in tabletop all the time out of necessity is tying things together. They have to because
if you want to,
just as in Cthulhu Chronicles, you have these characters that go from one challenge to another, and there has to be, like you said, connective tissue to figure out how these things thematically match up and all that.
Have you played any of the scenarios on tabletop that you've written into Cthulhu Chronicles?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I don't think so. Partly because I feel like that would be really weird. For me,
and it would kind insider. Of
there's a weird little thing that happens there when you play with more than one person, you know what I mean? When you have a full group, mm-hmm. things happen that you can't imagine. It never goes the way that you would think it would. So, I mean, I would definitely suggest you play some of these scenarios are really good. I would definitely if you have the opportunity that comes up. Especially,
I'll stop shying away from it then.
Yes, especially if somebody wants to run you the paper chase, you need to go ahead and just run the paper chase or play in the paper chase. That's a fun game.
Mm, gotcha.
They're all good.
They're all good.
I am fascinated actually about how you had to take these things and dissect them piece by piece. And really, I mean, you know these scenarios, I feel like, more than a keeper needs to know to run it for tabletop. I mean, you've structurally, you've had to map these out, I imagine.
Yeah.
Total detail and find decision trees. And
It's interesting because they're so basically what happened is that I read the original scenarios cover to cover many times to dissect them. And then as I was remastering them, I feel like I've muddled the two together, if that makes sense, in my head. But the process of adapting these was for about a month. I sat with the scenarios and I dissected what the common motifs were, what the common narrative threads were, who the characters were that really stood out to me, and ways to tie these together and bridge those gaps between disparate adventures, which is part of why these original adventures cropped up. I guess you're going to see the style guide actually when the closed beta starts. That's like the style guide and all that stuff will be on the platform. But the style guide is like an in-depth dissection of here's sort of how you write monsters. Here's how you convey horror through imagery and sensory experiences. Here's like recurring motifs. Here's recurring themes. Here's like different angles to approach like common tropes. And here are those tropes and things like that.
Oh, that's great. So it's not just, you say style guide and I'm thinking Oxford comma, not Oxford comma. you're really talking about the advice for writers.
Yeah, it's really an IP style guide, like a breakdown of what makes the IP the IP and intellectual property, just in case anyone listening didn't know. But that's like what makes Call of Cthulhu Call of Cthulhu, what makes, and more specifically, what makes Cthulhu Chronicles adaptation of Call of Cthulhu what it is. And then we also have that for Tunnels and Trolls. And it's very different from a technical style guide, which we also have, of best practices for here's how you do dashes, here's how you do certain types of punctuation, here's how many words there should be in a frame, things like that. But the style guides for each IP are very detailed, and they're almost like a glossary or maybe encyclopedia of facets of the IP to explore and ways to apply them to your writing.
Yeah, I just want to read that in a book. I mean, that sounds amazing, just analysis-wise.
When that engine becomes available, is it assumed that a person would need to have, like, technical, like, development knowledge to use it?
Oh, no. So that's the whole premise of our company. The reason our CEO started our company and Meta Arcade, and by the way, I keep forgetting to mention this, go to metaarcade.com, two A's in the middle, metaarcade.com, to sign up for the closed beta and join a mailing list. You can also talk to us on Discord and all this crazy stuff.
We'll have H2 font size linked so that you can just
thanks. Yeah, make it like flashing and bold, like do a blingy banner of it.
We'll talk to Dan about that. Sure. Yes. Sounds good.
Thank you.
I was trying to close a pop-up and I ended up on Meta Arcade, but it's awesome.
It won't leave me alone. Sorry. What was the question? I've forgotten.
Well, I don't know. Oh, so was it me? No, sorry, it was John. Sorry.
No, it was you hush, Chad.
I don't know what John's question is. I never do.
I was getting to, because this sounds so cool, but I am such a Luddite, as my co-host will attest, that something that, what to me sounds very technical, you know, I'm playing the Cthulhu Chronicles game, and I'm thinking, this is awesome. I could never be a creator for this.
Oh, it's too that's technical. Where you're wrong. No, you know? We're here to prove you wrong. I'll go back to, I think what I was originally getting at, which I totally slipped my mind after I derailed myself. The Meta Arcade company vision, the premise on which it was founded, the dream at the end of the rainbow is a creative engine that allows people with no technical or artistic skill to write and publish their own interactive adventures. So
there you are.
There's going to be art. All of the technical crunchy stuff is not swept under the rug, but sort of veiled a little bit. The things that are surfaced in the engine are, okay, do you want to do an attribute check? You know, this is the most technical it gets. Like if the player has charisma over 6, they can go down this path. If they don't, they go down this path. That's about as technical as it gets. And all of this stuff, you don't have to type any code. You don't have to do anything. It's all like buttons and drop-down lists and just...
That's cool. So I don't have to like do a bunch of Lua scripting or anything like that in order to get my objects in there.
We make the Lua for you.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you for that. I'm fighting that with a different platform right now, actually. It's very frustrating.
Oh, boy. Good luck. Well, you should join our closed beta.
I'll just give up. I've actually already signed up for the closed beta, so hopefully I'll get
mine. You have? Yeah. What happened? What?
Sorry.
While we were talking? How did you... What happened?
There's this thing called the internet, Chad. One day, we'll explain it to you.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing what you can do on it.
Huh. It's just real talk. How do you do that?
You go to the website.
is there a sign up for the beta on the site?
If you go to metaarcade.com, there's an email entry field. If you put in your email there, you will join our newsletter and you'll get updates leading up to the closed beta in February. And you can also, through that, join our Discord, where you can talk to us, the developers, directly. I'm in there all the time, just reading, talking about Pi, things like that, you know, pretty casual, fun stuff.
Pie that you bake, or the
Oh, no,
the
pie, pie that I make, yeah.
Okay. Let's talk pie. Sorry. Anyway, I'm trying to get to the Medicaid. I'm trying to sign up right now, which is a little bit rude.
I don't think it's rude if it's something I've actually told you to do. I think that's probably fine.
fair. That's fair.
You heard the call to action and you answered it, and I appreciate it.
That's right. That's right. I'm stepping right up.
Makes for good radio, listening to Chad.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody else talk.
Listening to Chad fill in boxes. Yeah. You notice how long it's taking him to enter in an email address, by the way. I'm just saying.
Well, I've got the Twitter account. I don't think this is... We're going to be cutting this out. Sean?
What do you mean?
Could you just run the browsing filter, cut out on any browsing activities?
Right. In other words, cut it and put it to the end of the show so we can all laugh at Chad later.
Well,
or we could laugh at him now.
We'll do both.
That's also fine.
But the world will laugh at him later.
Par for the course.
Have we covered that sign up? Have we covered the call for creators? Is there anything else you want to say about getting people into this thing?
Not really. Honestly, if you go to metaarcade.com, put in your email, join our mailing list, join our Discord. That it's all about getting feedback, getting, you know, hearing what people want to see from us and incorporating that into what we're doing moving forward. Mainly on the Discord server, but also you can email us directly. And I think the exact email for that is on our website. But yeah,
sweet.
Everything is there. I promise.
I just signed up for the beta.
Oh man, John beat me.
Yeah, that's saying something right there, man.
I have now signed up as well.
The Luddite beat you.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
I'm in the Discord.
Oh really? You're already in the Discord? Is that possible? Just get an invite.
If I run the Discord right now, it'll crash me.
Yeah, let's not do that, John. Yes, let's not crash.
Yeah, I'm very excited by this. Thank you, Sam, for informing us of this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for getting excited about it. It's really nice, because that's what we feed off of as developers, is other people's excitement, and then we vampirically absorb it and use it to fuel ourselves moving forward. So, yeah.
Okay. So y'all should be creeped out. All you creators, be concerned about your energy levels.
I wrote Cthulhu Chronicles. Of course I'm a little bit creepy.
That's how Meta Arcade is going to live for thousands of years on our souls.
For people who... We have a lot of listeners who either dabble in or are professional Call of Cthulhu writers in the tabletop realm. And this just sounds like great practice to do on both sides, actually.
Yeah.
People who are doing the interactive fiction to maybe consider trying tabletop and the other way around. It sounds
exactly.
like great. Yeah,
exactly. That's our CEO is one of those people who has played a lot of tabletop games and who has written scenarios for a lot of tabletop games just as a hobby and has never had an outlet for them before. So he founded the company as a way of giving himself and people like him an outlet for that.
Pretty awesome.
Well, I hear the pipes, and this rat is a coming.
So. Is that what is? Oh, a Pied Piper. Okay, Got it. I was mixing the rat things and the Azathoth pipers and
Sean, if you could put in an obvious soundbite there to lead in Chad, that'd be great.
That'd be great.
Thanks.
And you mentioned that you've always been kind of a fan of horror and cosmic horror, especially.
It's interesting because I wouldn't say always. As a kid, I was like super scared of even like not very scary movies. And then in college, I sort of started to get into horror and creepy stuff. I liked reading creepy stuff as a kid, but visually I got into it in college, and that's actually also where
visually.
I read visually. Yes.
I'm sorry. How do you visually get into it? Just curiosity.
Oh, like films.
Oh, gotcha.
Oh, okay, I gotcha.
Yeah. That's actually college was also where I first read H.P. Lovecraft as part of a zombie. It was a literary genre studies class focused on zombies. So we studied like pulp comics and old short stories and even novels like World War Z and things like that. And one of the short stories was a H.P. Lovecraft short story.
Was it Herbert West Reanimator?
No, it was, I think it was some just like very, very racist thing about like Haitian voodoo and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Which it right. was, yeah, it was interesting. Like so much of old zombie stuff and old horror stuff is rooted in that kind of thing. And it's like, oof, it's pretty important moving forward to try to divorce ourselves from that. Or not divorce so much as be cognizant of it. And I talked about that a little bit at the panel that I think you saw me at, but
yes, yeah. You did at Gen Con. Yep. Yeah. Not so much, trying to forget it or trying to wash it, but, working mm-hmm. with it and acknowledging it. Yeah. And, trying to figure out how to turn it into something useful in contemporary times.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the things that are really interesting about cosmic horror are not rooted in the very problematic, like sort of bad, threads through like a lot of H.P. Lovecraft's original writing. I think the reason that his writing is still relevant and the reason why people still like it is because despite those things, there's a lot to relate to and gravitate towards in terms of, you know, feelings of loneliness and fear of the unknown and the helplessness that you feel when you're, you know, faced with something so much greater than yourself. I think those are still very relatable themes, and those are really what cosmic horror is founded on to me. And that's why I like writing it.
Right on. You said something at the panel that really was interesting about the very last second. Somebody asked a extremely sort of in-depth a conversation that could go on for hours about you know what do you do in a contemporary world with the themes of nihilism, mm-hmm. and I think the question asker was actually wasn't about making it relevant now, but anyway, your answer was really fascinating. We might even play it if at the end of the show, just for context. But you said something about it not really nihilism for yourself, for you mentioned your generation not being really so horrific and being something almost embraced, and how to find the heroism in that. Could you talk a little bit about what that was about?
Sure. So I'll start off by saying that I think the reason that my generation and younger generations are sort of nihilistic in a sort of self-aware, like almost meme-y, funny way, is because we grew up in a time where there's been a lot of uncertainty and a lot of change and a lot of self-awareness and information. Like it's from a young age now, people are more aware, I think, of death. Not to sound super grim or anything, I just mean that there's so much media and so much awareness and so many things going on that people in my generation and you know, younger people and older people and just I think a lot of people in general are feeling this sort of like, well, we're all gonna die one day. Like, yeah, that's we know. Like, but so
saturation of that, yeah, in media. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and especially with like rising depression rates and just like there's a lot of bad stuff going on. And at some point, you kind of just acknowledge it, and it at a certain point, it no longer bothers you. Like, not that everything is hopeless, but you realize, okay, I can't change this. These, you know, one day I will die. One, you know, and who knows when that day is. I may as well, you know, do what I can now. I may as well, you know, eat that piece of cake I want to eat. I may as well, you know, hold the door for this person to make their day a little better. Like, there, it's not about defeatism necessarily so much as acknowledging what you can and cannot do and working within those constraints to try to be a good person despite them. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very sort of existential approach of sort of if if life has no meaning from the outside, then it's got to be from the inside. And so exactly. What do you do with that? Yeah.
It's more stoicism than nihilism. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
Well, so but what if that isn't, I mean, you mentioned being sort of attracted to cosmic horror, but is there, if the nihilism doesn't cause dread, and maybe it does, maybe, I don't know, but if you don't feel that same reaction that maybe Lovecraft and contemporaries were going for in reinventing the gothic horror and turning it into this cosmic horror, what's the new, what freaks you out?
I don't think it's necessarily been replaced so much as there are aspects of the original Lovecraftian writings that have persisted and that specifically have persisted in my head and just stuck with me, of just loneliness and lack of control. And these are still sort of nihilistic things of like, I have no control over destiny. Correct me if I'm wrong about that being nihilistic. But it's the thing for me that is scary is the breadth of the unknown, and the fact that if you try to understand it, you will either die or go insane. That's one thing about Cthulhu that really just like, I just like, in writing it, I grapple with this idea that there's only so much you can convey of these, like through writing, of these otherworldly creatures and figures before they become too known. And once they're known, they're no longer cosmic horrors. Do you know what I mean? Like, part of the fear for me is, because I'm the sort of person who likes to just know things and do research and sort of have an understanding of the world around me in certain ways. And I think there's something very scary about the mutation of the known into the unknown and the unknowable. So for example, in Paper Chase, not to spoilers for anyone who hasn't played the scenario or the adventure in the app, one of the characters is a man who has been mutated into a ghoul. And the fear there is, you know, he was an intelligent guy who just happened to be too curious about the wrong thing. And that's a recurring thing across a lot of the stories and scenarios, is people who go poking where they shouldn't, even if they don't know they shouldn't. People who stumble onto something very bad. People who spiral down, like they find something and just follow it down and down and down until they are just completely lost in themselves and in this cosmic, uncontrollable force that they've basically willingly subjected themselves to and now can't distance themselves from because they've given up too much of themselves to learn about it. I rambled a lot. Did any of that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
No, yeah, totally.
Okay, cool.
The ghoul and even characters who make a very simple bargain. I'm wondering if I should be, how much I should be spoiling a Paper Chase, which is like my favorite scenario. but there are cases, let's say, where someone makes a pretty simple choice that is not necessarily altruistic, but is sort of like, well, this is a harmless thing that I really want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the spiral is, you know, begins with a very simple kind of pursuing, I don't know, just a human need, you know, for comfort of some kind.
I think also whenever we talk about cosmic horror, or especially Lovecraftian cosmic horror, you have you know, you make that simple choice, and then, or like Sam was saying, where they fold back in on themselves, you know, they just keep drilling down until it's smaller and smaller, and at some point they realize that they're past whatever it meant to be human, you know, and they've actually bridged mm-hmm. that strange gap between whatever we are and the utter unknown. And it's that moment when they, you know, when you click and you're like, oh crap, you know, that's the moment that I like, where, you know, that brief moment of realization before the complete and utter insanity hits, where you're just like, okay, I think I've gone too far, and oh yeah, okay, it's over now. You know what I mean? That there's yep. that little, there's a little snippet there where you're, you know, you're kind of bridging a threshold almost, where between what it means to be human and what it means to be something you can't quite understand, and anything is possible in that moment.
I completely agree. And not to get too spoilery, but if you haven't already played the last scenario, Blackwater Creek, you're going to like it. Because that moment spoiler is... spoiler alert.
It's a right. good scenario.
Oh, it is.
It is right. a good scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm familiar scenario. With the tabletop one, yeah. so I can't wait to get to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you can probably imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, that moment where you realize that the alien is you is a common thread. In Lovecraft, I think, you know, there was an anxiety about his own parents' mental illness. But even just coming in contact with knowledge that a bell you can't unring, and then realizing that the alien is you because you no longer recognize yourself. That's definitely a cosmic horror that's not like the insignificance necessarily, which isn't the only thing about cosmic horror, but that insight about yourself being the alien is resonant to me.
Yeah. I definitely relate to that a lot. For me, it's more of I'm queer, I'm non-binary and bi and all this stuff. And I always related more to monsters growing up than to human characters, because mm-hmm. monsters don't fit into any boxes. They don't have to by way of them being monsters. And there's something very human about monsters in a weird way.
That it's not they weird.
Are,
yeah. It's,
I mean,
they're it's created in out of our own way. Fears yeah. and our own desires and our own exactly. insecurities. I mean, they're born out of us. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So monsters 100%. Are just mere representations of those things that which we dread more than anything.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. It's interesting to see how the evolution of certain kinds of monsters has paralleled evolving societal fears.
For like sure.
How zombies once were sort of had some problematic implications and have evolved to be more of a fear of death and infection and apocalyptic things and loneliness and, you know, could you survive in that scenario? Things like that, where because societal fears and personal fears have evolved and have changed and shifted, the monsters that reflected the fears that have changed also change with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to think of an example where an existing monster, a myth has been reimagined.
I just remembered a really interesting example is you know the movie The Shape of Water that came out?
Oh yes, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Guillermo del Toro, the way he talks about monsters just like speaks to my heart. It's like, I think there's a great quote from him that was like, he grew up with monsters and monsters like in a way saved him from feeling like alone or you know, because they are the most alone, but with them you'd never be alone. I'm getting a little wrapped up in my own words here, but what I mean is monsters give you permission to be real and weird in a way that human societal expectations don't always. That's why, I mean, you can go into a whole thing about how and I guess I will, about how a lot of villains and monsters are queer-coded or are racially coded, and that is because minorities are the other, so they're projected onto this very distant and sort of ultimate expression of the other, which is, you know, inhuman.
Yeah.
And a lot of, it's not like we had a choice, but a lot of people like me, who grew up with very limited representation in those ways, that's part of why we like monsters and the villainous characters so much, is because, well, you have to sort of embrace that. In a way, it is representation, even if it's not, even if it's rough to have that be the majority of your representation, like queer-coded villains being what they are, they're still interesting characters, and I think people have sort of reclaimed those sure. in an interesting way. Like, they're meant to alienate minorities as using them as an expression of the other in relation to the usually heterosexual white protagonists. But in a way, communities have rallied around those characters, because they kind of have to. We kind of have to appreciate what representation we have. And there is something empowering about villains and monsters don't have to care what people want them to be. They don't have to fit into any boxes. And there's something very inspiring about the way, say, Maleficent in Sleeping Beauty just, like, is the Empress of Evil and just goes after it and, like, lives for the drama and just turns into a dragon and kills people and curses a princess. There's something kind of great about that, in a way. Not that I would recommend doing that in real life or anything, but
right, do not
in a sort of fantasy sort of way. You know, we've right. all been neglected. You know, like not gotten an invitation to the party you wanted to go to and wanted to show up and crash it and be like, you thought you could leave me out of this? Well, have I got something for you? Like
fire breath.
Yeah, here I yeah. am, a dragon. Yeah.
Yeah, that made me think of the queer culture in New York, club culture, the club kids and Michael Ehrlich and the party monsters, right? This was a very literal absorbing of the monster identity that...
Reminds me of the Babadook as well, right? That was kind of...
Oh, gosh.
It's a whole thing.
That's the... So the root of that is Netflix... erroneously categorizing it, well, right. potentially erroneously categorizing it as a LGBTQ movie in its filing, and the queer community was like, "Yep, okay, you can't, no take backs, like the Babadook is gay now, like no, you gave this one to us, this one's ours now, like." And I remember seeing photos of people dressed up as the Babadook at pride parades and just like. Just going for it, because it's it's rare and wonderful to get to claim a character like that. It's rare and wonderful for a minority group to get that kind of opportunity. Do you know what am I making mm-hmm. sense? Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Totally. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think another reason I like monsters is because they are allowed to be like scary and gross, in a way that, you know, people aren't really like, I'm going to talk about Shrek now, if that's okay.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. Shrek cast.
Well, first of all, I love Shrek. Shrek
all
one and
them?
Two specifically.
Okay.
No, Shrek one and two. No,
okay.
please.
Good. So I'm just making sure, you know.
Okay, that's I can't fault you for that, but also how dare you even think for a second. Anyway, one of the reasons I really like Shrek is the end of the first movie. I mean, I'll say spoiler alert, but like it's been out for a long time, so and everyone knows it. Fiona at the end becomes a monster, like, and they double down on it in the sequel where. like Shrek takes this happily ever after potion and he becomes human and Fiona becomes human again too. And they're both like pretty and white. And then the end, their happy ending at the end of that movie is like, no, I definitely want to be an ogre again. Like he gives Fiona the choice and she's like, no, I want to be like big and green and gross. Let's do this thing. Like,
yeah,
there's a really empowering embracing of these two people being in love and being very happy and also being like gross and scary and weird and outsiders, and choosing that lifestyle, like actively choosing it in both movies.
Yeah. For the scenarios that, I'm dancing around spoilers. Have you created any monsters of your own?
Have I created any monsters of my own?
Whole cloth. I mean,
whole cloth.
My monsters just went to bed. So
sure. Okay.
For Cthulhu Chronicles, not exactly. There's a monster in The Good Professor who I don't really name and I don't really specify what it is. So I don't think that really counts.
I don't know. That counts, I think.
Okay. Well, I pretty much made it up whole cloth, because that's an original scenario. But I didn't name it or give it any particularly. I
mean, we just did a review of an old scenario, Crooked and Cracked Mance, where the monster was literally named the monster.
Nice.
In lowercase, you know what I mean? Like he didn't have a name for it either. It's totally, I think that's, you can claim that.
Hmm. Oh no, wait, no, we actually ended up using artwork that Chaosium provided us of a Gug. So I think technically it is a Gug.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Dang it. Gug. Ugh. So close and yet so far.
I mean, it's just the art. So
it's just
are the
art,
details.
Though, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what are the details
that are
unique?
Yeah, maybe it's, you know, like a pseudo Gug or like a Gug
cousin
or something.
Well, that's one of the things we always talk about is always changing the monster. Like, even if it is a Gug, this for some reason is not a normal Gug, so that the normal players don't always catch up on, it must be a Gug, you know, so you want to try and flip it around a little bit. So maybe this is some kind of strange, you know, aberrant Gug.
I believe you've done that, if I'm not mistaken.
Shh.
Okay.
I think we did do that exact example, actually.
Right.
I'll find a show note. Hang on. No, just joking.
Okay. Sure. Well, that may be, a show.
Was it?
I don't know. Do we want to go? I don't know.
Did we go into rethinking cosmic horror in general?
Yeah. Did y'all have something that you can imagine twisting cosmic horror for either a more contemporary or your own personal, new angle?
I mean, I put some thought into it as far as how I could reimagine cosmic horror at the game table. And my thought was to really try and personalize it for the player as they're playing. So as a investigator is losing sanity, say, and has had a bout of madness, in addition to the insanity rules and the things that we can inflict on that player and that character that modifies their gameplay at that moment, I was thinking you could expand that and find different ways that player now interacts with the game. So you could change things like the way that he has to roll dice, right? So now, because the you've been inflicted by the mythos and your perceptions are skewed, you no longer get to just roll percentile dice. You're going to roll percentile dice and a d20 and add that d20 to whatever it is that you roll, on certain occasions. You wouldn't do it every time, but maybe you like anything that deals with your senses, right? The way your perceptions of the world around you, or you continually maybe have skew and change the things that they interface with. So maybe they see hallucinations, or suddenly you dive into their background and a relative that they, you know, just wrote off, oh, my dead grandfather, you know, just to kind of fill in the background of that character. Now that grandfather's alive, but not just because that character sees him alive, but everybody sees this guy as alive, and you still have memories of going to his funeral, but now grandpa's here. Well, you know, what's going on with that, right? So those were the kinds of things I was thinking about as far as changing a player's experience at the table to try and accentuate cosmic horror. I don't know if it works or not, but something I came up with.
Yeah, you couldn't hear me doing it, but I was nodding emphatically through the whole thing you were doing. Yes, I didn't want to interrupt, but yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I totally agree that making things personal is, I think, the most effective form of horror. Because if you can tap into a person's individual fears, that's when things really kick off, I think. Not that I can really do that as a writer of, like, a one-way mirror sort of experience with Cthulhu Chronicles, but I at least try to draw on my own sort of fears. Yeah.
Well, it's successful in that if it taps into a reader's personal, you know, by analogy, their fears. Yeah.
And if I can make it personal, that's when, if I can make a reader or a player feel what I'm writing, like through sensory detail, through description of what's happening, if I can make the player experience it and really feel the moment and feel fear because of what I've written, that is key. If it's something they wouldn't have even been afraid of, but maybe I've described it in such a way, or I've added details that really make them afraid, that's when it's really rewarding for me. My cat is going crazy. Stop. Stop it. Please. Turn the podcast.
Turn on the camera. I want to see the cat going crazy.
I'll show her to you afterwards.
Okay.
I don't want to derail too much. Sorry, I just had to get her to stop scratching the damn carpet.
My cat has cosmic horror of every shadow.
I think my cat thinks that every visitor to our apartment is Cthulhu himself.
Oh, yeah.
And just bolts.
Nice.
Under the couch kind of cat.
Oh, yeah.
Visible cat, yeah.
I had a cat that was in the couch kind of cat.
Oh, nice.
That was not a pleasant thing to find out, though.
Yeah.
Sam Reardon, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been awesome.
Super fun talk.
Yeah,
really rich for sure. Stuff. Thank you.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Well, anytime you want to come back, you just let us know.
Cool.
For
thank you.
Sure.
You Absolutely guys should right. hop on the Meta Arcade Discord, and we can keep in touch in the meantime. You can get all the cool updates about what we're doing. Close
I'm
beta.
Already there.
Thank you.
There. Awesome.
That will happen.
Cool. Cool.
We want to hear from our listeners, and we have lots of ways you can reach out to us.
For the complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion. Record a liner, tell us who you are, and give us a hearty go pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all those links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/165.
Thank you for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license.
Cthulhu Reborn has released a free/pay what you want scenario if you want a 27-page PDF scenario for Dateline Lovecraft. It is written by Noah Lloyd, who is half of the Reckoning of the Dead website. Pardon me there. It is described.
Sorry, don't do that.
You can't, yeah, you
do
can't not, change it when I'm.
You don't did it.
Edit.
Can't do it when I because then Damn my it, eyes man. Moved.
I know. Don't do it.
You
what?
Did it.
I don't know what, why you did.
Why
that.
Are you saying don't do I it?
No, I'm scolding myself. Would you guys stop scolding me for scolding myself?
No, I will continue to scold
Scolders.
You. All right. Let me
start over.
Start over.